This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done things and endured things that most of us would have a hard time imagining. That's the case today as we pick up where we left off last time with 92-year-old Ray Maloney of Bonita Springs, Florida. If you missed the first half of the interview, you can find that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. Shot down on his 37th mission as a P-47 Thunderbolt pilot with the 86th Fighter Bomber Group, the 527th Squadron, Ray was hurt badly and captured by German forces. In fact, the first prison camp he ended up in was Stalag Luft 3 in Zagan, which is now within Polish borders, and that's the camp where a couple famous prisoner escapes occurred, inspiring the classic movie, The Great Escape. Something tells me you heard about those escapes.
In fact, I talked to some of the fellows who had escaped and were recaptured and weren't part of the 50 that were executed. 76 got out, and 3 made it to Sweden. So, but the Germans recaptured 73 of them and executed 50 of them. Mm-hmm. And so the other 20-some were put back in the camp, and I got to talk to a couple of them off and on. They were all mostly RAF guys, you know.
Well, and you would end up spending a lot of time with the RAF guys.
Yeah, I was in the compound with them, yeah. I was the only American in my room. They were all Englishmen.
What was life like in that POW camp on a day-to-day basis? What kinds of things did you do to pass the time, and what kind of kept you going?
Well, first of all, you know, as I mentioned when we started talking, Paul, being a prisoner of war is a degrading, humiliating kind of experience, and it's not something that I'm proud of. It didn't take any skill or, you know, specialty to get captured. And because I didn't finish my tour, and a lot of my friends did, and a lot of my friends were killed, I always felt guilty about being, and I could tell from talking to other people in the camp, they have the same feeling, that it's a terrible guilt feeling that you're not helping at this point, you know. Even though your instructions are, when you are captured, you are still a military, you're still U.S. Army, and your responsibility is to do what you can to, you know, confuse, confound, and, you know, aggravate the enemy as much as you can.
That's probably my favorite line from that movie, The Great Escape. It's put so well by, I think, one of the British officers, the character in that film, where he says it's the sworn duty of every serviceman to escape, do everything he can to escape. So did you do any of those things?
Well, I was, you know, a junior. Here I am, a second lieutenant. Yeah. I'd just been shot down, and I was in a room with fellows that had been down since Tobruk, you know, 4 years before that, you know. So they had all the experience in the world. And I was a know-nothing, you know, an American. But you knew that they had learned over the months and years how to survive mentally and emotionally, you know, in a prison camp. And it helped me get through, you know. As you say, you've got this guilt feeling, and they would talk about it too, that, you know, we're here and we're not doing anything. But at the same time, I had heard stories about the Germans, at least the ones that ran the camps, were kind of single-minded, you know. And the British are delightful at deceiving, and, you know, what looks like something is not really it. You know, the British are great at this.
Uh-huh.
And they would, the story I used to get was that they would occasionally leave a plan for tunnels that didn't exist, you see. And they'd leave them somewhere where the German ferrets, we used to have guards come through with overalls on and screwdrivers and flashlights, and they were forever climbing under the barracks or in the attic, you know, something, trying to find what we're doing, you know, escape activities. They would just go in great glee when the Germans had found some plan for underground tunnels, you see. And then the Germans would bring in trucks to ride around the outside to try to collapse any of the tunnels and drive big iron bars down into the ground, you know, to feel if they're going to hit the top of the tunnel. And the Brits would just sit there, you know, and giggle and watch all this, you know.
That's classic.
It was nothing, yeah. They knew how to survive, you know. They had a little library. The Swiss Red Cross, the International Red Cross, of course, used to, I'll talk about the food in a minute, but the Red Cross got in a few books and a couple of guitars and a bugle or something, and so the guys that could play. And, you know, this compound that we were in had 1,400 British guys and 212 Americans. But even in that small of cadre, no matter what you wanted to do, you could find somebody that knew how to do that, you know, whether it was play an instrument or run a railroad or dig tunnels or run trains or, you know, photograph. And you remember in the movie, and a lot of that was true, they were actually getting photographs and reproducing railroad passes and identification papers with photographs on them. And we even, I shouldn't say we, the British had it, they had a two-way radio in the camp.
That they avoided having captured, which must have been pretty tricky to have it confiscated.
Well, we were counted twice a day, once in the morning and once just before dinner. And the radio would go out into the compound in the pockets of about 50 or 60 people. Each one had little parts of it. Yeah. And when the only time the radio came together, it was when in the evenings the British BBC would broadcast the news at dictation speed. And this was given to some underground transmission station in Poland. And Sagan was right on the Polish border. In fact, now Sagan is in Poland.
Right, but, where Stalag Luft 3 was.
Yeah, where Luft 3 was. And the Polish underground would retransmit this. And somebody, and I never knew, you know, the fewer guys that knew about these things, the better off. Somebody would put the radio together, listen to the news, copy it down on a little piece of paper, and somebody would go around to each barracks and room by room, and he'd come in at nighttime and he'd hand you this piece of paper. You weren't allowed to talk about it or anything. You read it and give it back to him, and then he gives it to the next guy. So each guy in a room reads it, and then he takes it to the next room. And so that's how you know what's going on, you know.
And you had to do it that way to avoid losing this great privilege of getting some outside information.
That's right. That's right. And the other, as I say, it was a two-way radio. When a new prisoner, Kriegsgefangenen was the name for war prison in Germany. When a new Kriegi came into the camp, one of the first things they would do was a committee would interrogate him. First of all, they wanted to decide whether he was a true ally, you know, whether he was what he said he was, you know, instead of some a German plant.
So the prisoners would interrogate the new prisoners.
New prisons, right. Yeah. First of all, was to find out if you were valid, you know, if you were, say, you were what you were. And that was the first thing. The second thing was, how did you get captured and what part of Germany and how did you get gone? Tell me all about it. And we came up the Brenner Pass, you know, from Italy to get into Germany. And they wanted to know all about the Brenner Pass and all of the, you know, what I saw, anti-aircraft placements and stuff going up. And all of that would be transmitted out to the Polish underground, back to England. And so they were putting all this stuff together. It was
so you were saying earlier how so many of you felt useless or guilty that you weren't helping. But, I mean, these guys are passing on some pretty important strategic information.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some of it was, you know, quite valuable. For evading, for instance, I had heard stories about always look like you belong where you were, you know, like you were part of the community. And so there was one story about a fellow who stole a cow and walked it across half of France. In fact, walked the cow to death. The cow died.
There goes his cover.
Yeah, the cow died, I heard. And the other one was a guy stole a wheelbarrow and pushed the wheel down halfway across Germany and France, you know, to get out of these places.
And did you ever seriously contemplate escape, not knowing how long you're going
to
be there?
Yes, I did to the extent that in talking to some fellows in my very room, they wanted to know, about 2 miles up the road from Sagan was a fighter base, an advanced training for 109s, ME-109s. And the 109 guys knew that this was an air camp. All the airmen were in this camp. And they used to buzz us all the time, right across the top of the thing. And then we all look up and say, spin in, you. But anyway, to answer your question about my escape, it never came about. But when they asked me, they said they were cooking up something to see if they could get a few guys down to the airbase and steal some airplanes and crank them up and go. And they were ME-109, so they wanted fighter pilots.
Right.
And it so happens that I was the only fighter pilot in my room. They were all bomber.
Yeah,
Lancaster.
These would all be bomber crews.
Yeah,
mostly.
These were all bomber crews, navigators. And
that kind of underscores something. I don't want to get off on a tangent. Mm. But you said earlier you had only considered finishing your missions or being killed. Really, for fighters, that was the more likely scenario. There weren't a whole lot of fighter pilots who became prisoners of war. I mean, there were some.
Yeah.
But you were most. I mean,
yeah,
you were
right.
Much more likely to be a POW on a bomber crew than a fighter pilot.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So you beat some odds there, just surviving.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
When I said I'd consider escaping. And so a few days later, a guy came to me, came into the room, British RAF guy, and he had a little pack. He said, "You're Lieutenant Maloney?" And I said, "Yes, yes." And identified myself, and so he knew I was the guy. And he said, "All right." He opened up this little pack, and he handed me about 4 or 5 photographs of the cockpit of a ME-109.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, big, 8.5 by 11. And he said, "Study these, and I'll be back in about an hour and so and take them." He said, "I won't leave them overnight with you." I said, "Okay." So I studied them for a while, and he came by, and we did this for about 2 or 3 times. Meanwhile, there was some activity going on somewhere that they don't tell you about, about how you're going to get out of here. But I did my part, and I do remember another thing that occurred in my room was we got in a checker game with a checkerboard, and the fellows in the room took a sponge with some water and wiped warm water it across the back side of the checkerboard, right? And when it was kind of soaked, and I thought they were going to ruin this thing, they peeled off the back layer, and here was a silk map of Germany, and a really fine map. It was the ones that, like, they had in your escape kit.
Uh-huh.
We used to carry a little escape kit with a medical syringe and a few things and a compass, chocolate bar, and a map and some German money and stuff,
uh-huh.
Like that, a little tiny pack. And so they were going to use this, and that disappeared. But I saw this silk map come out the back of the thing. And they had buttons that were compasses.
You mean shirt buttons?
Shirt buttons, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And a little metal button, and it kind of had a flat edge. And then a little thing on top, and a little dab of, I guess, some magnetic something on the thing. And what you had to do was put a needle or a pin on top of it and let it just sit there. And the little thing would turn, and you had a compass.
Ingenious.
Yeah, it was. It was incredible. But this was all part. Oh, and another part of the escape activities, we always kept track of what Germans were in the camp. And the nearest barracks to the gates where they came and went through the gun, in one of the rooms where you were within sight of that, and I caught this duty a few times, you'd sit there, and everybody that came in, you had a book, and you'd write down what time. And if you didn't know who it was, you described him, German with a hat and this or that, or what his rank was or something. And he went to barracks number so-and-so at such a time. And so they kept track of where every German was in that compound all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We knew. So if the Germans ever gotten close to where they were digging a tunnel or doing something, immediately everything would be shut down and they'd come out of the tunnel and, cover up everything within a matter of just a few seconds if some German headed to the wrong barracks. And this was done all the time. And I can remember sitting there by the hour watching these guys come through and try to describe who it was writing in the book. You never felt that you were out of the military. You were still in the military, and we had a senior RAF group captain who was the senior man in our compound, and we did what he said. Now, the food.
I've heard some stories now.
Yeah, right. The movies never describe, never get into this. But there is an absolute eternal hunger, a yearning for food. You don't get enough food, and you're hungry. It's gnawing at you.
Well, most of us have no idea what that feels like. It's break time, but when we come back, we're going to find out what kept Ray alive in captivity, and what did it feel like to become a free man again after six excruciating months. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.